It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a new education bill Republican state lawmakers are supporting.
But first, this Saturday is National Adoption Day, an annual nationwide effort to raise awareness of more than 100,000 children in foster care waiting to find permanent families.
We often see celebrities grabbing headlines for adopting children from foreign countries, but what about adoption right here in our state? Joining us now to talk about adoption in Wisconsin is Oriana Carey. She's Executive Vice President of the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families. Oriana, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with a really basic question. If somebody has the notion, we should adopt kids, that's overwhelming. Where does somebody start?
A good place to start in our state is with our agency. Our agency is funded by the Department of Children and Families to give information to Wisconsin residents on everything related to adoption in foster care in our state. And I say that because the type of adoption, what's happening in your family, all those pieces, we have website, email, people who can answer those phone calls and talk to you about all that.
What kind of questions, when people make that first contact, what kind of questions do they need to start with? What kind of things do they need to consider about whether to adopt and then what path to choose?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. What do I want? What is in my family type, my tolerance for certain things? All of adoption requires a great deal of patience. The process to get through the process is patience. Someone's going to come into your home. Someone's going to study your family, your background, ask you some intrusive questions. Are you open to that? Are you accessible to that? And that's why I say we can talk you through a lot of those pieces.
I'm an adoptive parent myself, and I joked that the process replaced pregnancy with paperwork.
Yes. Often many people will say that. In addition, there's training and classes that families have to go through and waiting. I would say when people call us, even after they've begun the process, I think that frustrating piece is waiting.
Mm-hmm. How big a need is there for, I'll open it up here, adoptive parents in the state and foster parents here in Wisconsin?
Well, we have a great need for foster parents in the state of Wisconsin. And when people call us and they call us about adoption for foster care, they often hear us say that first. And that is because in foster care and when someone's not safe in their home, the first goal of foster care is to return children to their families. And when that's not possible, we do look for an adoptive resource for them. And so we talk people through that process of tolerance and your family type and what happens. Most children in Wisconsin are reunified with their families. And so we want to make sure people understand that going into the process.
And that could be a birth parent or another family, a biological family member, right?
Absolutely.
So it can sound daunting to become a foster parent, first of all. What kind of help, if somebody signs up to do this, would they get? And does it vary from, you know, if you're taking in infants versus teenagers?
Well, in Wisconsin, in foster care, our counties license foster parents, as well as some private agencies within a treatment foster care sort of arrangement. The counties do provide, everyone is required to have training and to go through the training process. Every child that's in foster care has a child welfare worker assigned to them. That worker helps the family in finding services, making sure that the needs of the child and the family are being met, and they work through that process and build a plan. And as you said, it's going to depend. Teenagers have some different needs than infants have some different needs and those sorts of things.
Now, turning to the adoptive side of things again, as I understand it and recall, when you adopt here in Wisconsin, you are actually a foster parent for a period of time first.
Yes. You have to be a foster parent first.
Mm-hmm. So talk us through the different paths to adoption here in the state and what people go through.
Well, as we talked about first, you know, there is adoption through foster care. And many families that choose to foster, if, again, that plan is not reunification, they do become the adoptive resource for that child. That is one route. There is also the route of adopting an infant privately through with an agency or working through attorneys. And there is also the process of adopting children internationally. The same thing. We would encourage people to call. We have that same information about the various private adoption agencies in the state of Wisconsin. We will not recommend any one agency. What we do is we try to help people be good consumers, ask good questions, talk to the agencies about what they're looking for.
And do different agencies provide better fits for different people based on their needs?
I think people have to ask those questions. I think they really have to talk through and interview the agencies that they're prospectively going to work through.
Now, people, sometimes we hear complaints about the difficulty or the long time, the paperwork that you mentioned. How do you respond to that? Why do we need a complicated, long process here?
I would say we have to first look at what we're talking about here. We're talking about children. And when we're talking about children, anything related to children, I believe when people take a step back from the frustration, they can think, yep, we want kids protected. We want kids in a good, safe place. We want that to be a forever home. And so that takes a little bit longer than people may like.
I want to look at the other side of the adoption scenario here and at the birth parent and birth parents. Mm-hmm. What kind of things do they consider and what kind of points of contact are there for them if they're thinking maybe the best thing we can do is put a child up for adoption?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. We're actually the agency that's available for birth parents considering that plan as well. So the same sort of thing, we talk with them about the same process. We won't recommend an agency. Here are the agencies that work with birth families. You deserve to work with somebody who's going to give you some counseling about the process and talk to you through the process. And we give them lots of recommendations and we tell them to keep talking to people until they feel comfortable.
Yeah, this is an emotionally difficult process, I imagine, for the birth parents. How do they stay in contact with the help they need? What do they need to work through?
Again, all the licensed agencies in this state provide what is called birth parent counseling, and they talk them through the process. Also in Wisconsin, most of our agencies, whether we don't have a full-fledged open adoption law, they work really well with birth parents and prospective adoptive parents together, and they talk about what that contact is going to look like post-adoption. And so we've come a long way in that process.
Yeah, how have attitudes toward adoption and policies toward adoption changed in Wisconsin to help people on all sides, the birth parents, the adoptive parents, and the children?
Well, I would say we're continually working on that. You know, we're still working on it. One of the things in particular I would say is it's not been many years in Wisconsin that there was required training. That was one of the things that was a major thing not so many years ago. It's really important because there's some different nuances that happen within that adoptive child's life. Also, this last year, Wisconsin is one of the only states that makes it illegal to advertise children between when things aren't going well. And we are in the process right now. There is a legislative study committee that's looking at tightening up some things, headed by Representative Joel Clayfish, looking at tightening up some more things to make sure that children are in homes for the long haul, that families are supported, and that this truly does become a forever family process.
And are there provisions for legal advocacy and protection for everyone, birth parents, the child, and adoptive parents?
In our state, yes.
And
is
that unusual?
Every state, no, I wouldn't say, you know, there are federal and state laws over all of this. It's how people do that is a little bit different. But what I would, when you ask me about changes, I think one of the big changes that you're seeing happen is trying to take the adversarial process out of these children's issues and have people work collaboratively to the best interests of kids.
And again, can you leave us with some resources and starting points for people at any stage in this process?
As I said, I think the best place to start is contacting our agency. One of our websites, the easiest one to remember, is wiadopt.org. There's information. Also, the other easy one is wiadoptioninfocenter.org. So Wisconsin Information Center, Adoption Information Center. Our phone number is 1-800-762-8063. And either one of those websites that I just mentioned, if somebody just puts info@wiadopt.org, you send that email out and one of our staff will respond to your email and get you the information you're looking for.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Oriana Carey. She's Executive Vice President of the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families.
Wisconsin Republicans are working to pass a new school accountability bill once the next legislative session starts in January. While the draft that's circulating now isn't quite public yet, a similar bill fell short last session. Now that Republicans have a larger majority in the Wisconsin state government, this bill, as well as many other education initiatives that have failed to pass in previous sessions, are likely to be approved.
Scott Kirst is with us now to talk about this school accountability bill. He's an assistant professor of education at St. Norbert College. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me again.
Well, this issue of accountability, we hear it a lot at the state and national levels. What does accountability in Wisconsin schools look like now? What does it mean?
I guess the idea of accountability is that the general public, the public expects certain things out of their schools, certain things out of the public entities that they're putting together. And I think what this is a push on is that many individuals do not believe that schools are doing the job that they expect schools should do. Whether that's right or wrong, that's for the politics to determine. But really, when we talk about the idea of accountability, we talk a lot about how are we supporting our schools as well as a community? How are we accountable to the schools? I think the pushback comes from a lot of individuals believing that we're not providing the opportunities for all of the students across Wisconsin at an equal level. And so there's a little bit of a discontinuity between what some individuals believe accountability really means.
And in a lot of usages, it seems like it means a carrot and stick approach. All right, this school works well. We want to reward it in some way. This school is performing poorly. We want to punish it and or provide alternatives.
Exactly. And that's, I think, one of the things that Governor Walker is pushing forward is that he wants to create an entity in the Department of Public Instruction to actually say what are the criteria that we're able to give the carrots to and what are the criteria that we're going to be not be giving the carrots to, which is a little counterintuitive. You would almost think that the schools that have the most issues are the ones that need the most support and the most attention.
Well, the idea, I guess, would be that maybe these schools aren't managed well or something like that. There's something wrong, not in the community, not in community support, but structurally within the school that needs to change. So how can the state, or in this case, the DPI, incentivize, to use the economics word, that kind of change?
Mm-hmm. And I guess there already are mechanisms in place now to fix that. You can always have a different school board members. You can actually be pressuring. The community really should be involved in determining what is wrong with these schools. We're kind of taking it away from that community action and putting it more in the legislature and the DPI, where they might not actually have a close enough view or almost a personal view about that community school. I know a lot of places that are, there's a lot of issues that are at some schools, and the local community is the one that says, hey, we need to fix that. We're the ones that they're very proud of their schools. So there are mechanisms in place not only to fix schools, but fix, the quote unquote bad teachers. I'm not sure why this carrot and stick approach is needed.
Now, as we mentioned, this bill, isn't in full form mm-hmm. in the public yet, but it's expected to be close, and lawmakers seem to have suggested that it's going to be close to a bill that had passed, or not passed, I'm sorry, in previous okay. sessions because of closer margins and some Republicans not being on board. What do we know about that bill that didn't pass?
The one that didn't pass, a lot of the push against that was the idea of testing the private schools with the vouchers. That, if we are expecting our taxpayer money to go to these private schools, they should be held accountable at the same level as the public schools. And a lot of proponents were pushing, saying, you know, listen, we really need to make sure that, you know, without that, it's difficult to actually compare apples to apples, as we're talking about. So now there's a little bit more support saying, okay, well, what if, and, you know, there's a lot of ideas floated out there. What if we have different tests? What if we have different measurements? Can we correlate those together? So I think this bill that's coming up, it's trying to circumvent some of those problems that they had last time about the accountability of the private schools.
But it would still be a different test potentially for these choice schools, but maybe it's a matter of comparing, you know, Red Delicious to Jonagold apples or something, not apples and oranges here.
You know, exactly. And those are the things that we have to look at. I mean, what when we talk about college and career ready, what is a good measure of that? And really, when you look at the assessments that we have out there, the standardized testing we have out there, sometimes the big question is, are these really testing what we want our students to have out? And philosophically, is this the only measure that we should use? It's very easy for us to take a look at one school and say, that's a 168. And we take another school and we say, oh, that's a 172. And so therefore, I'm going to send my kids to 172. But if we don't understand what those numbers mean, it really is not, it's not a good way to compare the apples to apples.
We're talking to education expert Scott Kirst about a new school accountability bill Wisconsin Republicans are hoping to pass early in the next legislative session.
What do you think of this school accountability bill? To what standard do you think Wisconsin schools should be held, and why? Is it fair to compare public and private schools against the same standards? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We're continuing our conversation with education expert Scott Kirst about a new school accountability bill here in Wisconsin.
Republicans in the legislature hope to pass that bill early in the next session. We're taking your calls now. How do you think we should measure the success or lack thereof of schools here in Wisconsin? Should schools be rewarded or punished for their performance? If so, how do you think that should work? Is it fair to compare public and private schools, choice schools, using different testing standards? Teachers and principals, what do you think about how Republicans want to hold your schools accountable? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Brian on the line in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi. Our schools have the problem that they are structured on age cohorts, and kids develop at differential speeds and differential areas in their brains is one factor. And our accountability has traditionally been based on standardized pencil and paper tests, and many kids do not perform well in this particular medium. We have to provide for a variety of means of assessment. We have to, for all children, give a base level assessment of where the child is before the administration of instruction, and then measure the school by the progress the child makes from where they are, and not make assumptions that because a child is at X grade level, he should be at that particular level in any given particular topic. And this is the problem with all the accountability schemes that I've heard, is they don't allow for these different variables.
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. He brings up a lot and a lot of the concerns that people have, Scott, about accountability and in particular how you measure a school's performance and a child's performance.
And he makes an excellent point that we actually do. You know, we assume at a certain age every student meets all those milestones. And that's why it's so important to have the teacher know their students and support their students, so that they're the ones that are able to identify where they are, what instruction will bring them to an elevated level of learning, and then assess them there. And that's really what, you know, teacher preparation programs and teacher training programs and teacher professional development, that's really what we look at, that differentiation. Standardized testing could put a damper on that, because that standardized testing could be time in which we're actually getting to know our students one-on-one rather than just as a number.
Okay, but as a state policymaker, you want to have something to use to be able to look at a glance and see these schools are doing well, these are doing worse, and those more subjective types of evaluation may not cut the mustard. They may not provide you with any kind of information you can use.
And that's a great point. And I'm not saying that that's the only assessment you should be using. But we should also not use just standardized testing as the metric that we're looking for. It's a very complex process to evaluate where a student is, where a school is, where a community is. And I think boiling it down to a number is too easy. But it gives you no valid data. It just tells you you are 172 and somebody else is 168.
Back to our callers. We've got Arnold on the line in Verona. Arnold, hi.
Well, I think the discussion is misplaced. There's no exit exam. There's no exams for a diploma. There's no accountability comparatively in any district for all the money that's spent. There's no way to measure improvement. There's no entrance exams to any of the tech schools or universities. And there's a very high percentage of people who, when entering the secondary level or post-secondary level, have to take remedial courses, which nearly substantiates the failure of K-12 to begin with. So until you get some standards for graduation and diplomas, people are just talking about amorphous ideas, just a waste of time, everyone.
Arnold, thanks a lot for the call. So he'd like to see evaluation in the form of exit exams, graduation exams to get out of high school, Scott.
Very interesting. Again, that's going to be something that we would have to identify what are the skills. And if you ask 20 people what are the knowledge, skills, and dispositions a student should have at the end of 12th grade, you're going to get 20 different questions. So it all goes back even to the Common Core arguments that about throwing them out right now. No one can agree on those standards. No one can tell you what somebody should be when they're done with that 12th grade. Things are moving. The Common Core standards, we have those in place. Are they perfect? Of course not. But it's a start. It's a way to get moving. It's a way to have this dialogue. And perhaps something like that, when somebody gets, this whole idea of an exit exam, well, once we're understanding what we really do want from community members when they're 18, 19 years old, well, that'd be something good that we could pursue then.
Thanks for that call, Arnold. We'll go to Jake in Sheboygan. Jake, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess 2 points. One that concerns me is special education students and how they're involved in all this. Obviously, private schools have different rules to play under when accepting, rejecting, and educating special ed students. So even if the tests were the same, I'm not sure that we'd be testing apples to apples because of that. And the second thing, when this bill was first introduced last year, it had a lot to do with charter schools and being able to replicate and things of that nature. And I'm interested to get your feelings on how that is going to be used as a stick.
Thanks, Jake, for the call. So, Scott, to his first point about, he says the choice schools, private schools, aren't required to take special ed students. So that creates an imbalance in the evaluation department. Comparing public schools to the other schools.
That's absolutely correct. And most private schools do not have the resources nor the expertise in the teachers to actually accommodate the needs of special needs students. So, yeah, that is something that we'd have to take a look at. That, if I were to use a business analogy, if I could choose the raw materials that put into my product, my product may be superior to others because I know where my raw materials are coming from. Same thing with students. If you can just pick and choose, I don't know if we can compare that, somebody who's just picking and choosing the students they're accepting.
We heard from John on Facebook who says, rip away unprecedented amounts of funding, watch unprecedented low morale create early retirement and job seeking, and then try to toughen standards? Will there be any accountability, he asks, for all the new publicly funded private schools they want to create an increase in other legislation? There's a good chance that we'll see more kids able to go into choice schools. So he's worried that there's not going to be enough accountability. It'll be, I guess, NERF accountability for the choice schools.
And yes, that's absolutely true. I think many people start with the position that private schools, by de facto argument, are superior than public schools. And they say, well, if we can just get everyone in a private or a choice school, then everybody will improve. But when you really look at the facts and the research, you'd be hard-pressed to find a lot of data that says that they are better in any way than public schools. In fact, in some ways, they can be worse.
Now, getting back to the idea of sanctions on failing schools, the bill was this draft of the school accountability bill was authored by Senator Paul Farrow. And he says he didn't put sanctions for failing schools into the bill. As you mentioned earlier, he wanted to create a committee under the Department of Public Instruction to decide what to do. Are you surprised at that, that they didn't want to specify sanctions, that they put this into the hands of the DPI?
Well, and I think the issue is that they don't want to show all the cards that they have out right now. The problem is with the DPI. The DPI is a state entity. There has been some push to make that an appointed, the superintendent an appointed rather than an elected position. So, a lot of these structures, if they're in place, they can make things very difficult for school districts very quickly if the politics and the changes happen in our government.
And getting to the voucher students here, as I mentioned, looking at lifting the cap currently set at 1,000 mm-hmm. students and either having a higher number or no maximum number, what kind of effect would a higher cap have on education in Wisconsin?
Well, I think, like you said it before, you would have a lot of students obviously going to these choice or voucher schools. And the problem is we start talking about what is left. What students do we have that maybe don't have the ability to be transported to these choice schools? Or what if these ones, the ones where they just can't afford all those things? We start talking about how we're going to kind of get a class structure almost between these schools. You have the schools of the haves and the schools of the have-nots. And unfortunately, the have-nots could be our public school system.
Scott, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
That's Scott Kirst, Assistant Professor of Education at St. Norbert College. He was with us to talk about a new school accountability bill a Wisconsin Republicans in the legislature are planning to pass early in the next session. Actor and comedian Asif Mandvi is probably best known for his work as a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, acting as the show's senior Middle Eastern correspondent and senior Muslim correspondent, among others.
And while these characters may have helped to shape his career as a TV comedian and actor, they don't necessarily reflect his personal identity. Asif opens up about his life and upbringing in a new collection of personal essays called No Land's Man. Here's Asif Mandvi with Jack Black in the trailer for the book.
It's a collection of humorous essays about my life growing up in the U.S., growing up in the U.K., being an immigrant, being Indian, being Muslim, that kind of thing.
What? You're a Muslim?
Yeah, well, I was raised Muslim, yeah.
Are you fasting? I had no idea.
Oh,
I'm so sorry.
No, thank you so much. That's very kind of you, but no, I don't...
And I offered you a brewski! I'm such an idiot!
It's fine.
You need to pray?
Pray?
Yeah.
Right now?
No. Yeah. Because I know you guys pray a lot.
Asif, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So that clip there with Jack Black, it's kind of a running theme in your life. It seems as though people make these assumptions about who you are. You had kids calling you Curry Pot as a nickname when you were growing up in England. You had directors assuming that you would bring your own turban to shoots. How have you dealt with that as an actor and a comedian?
Well, I guess I absorbed it all and then wrote a book about it called No Land's Man. listen, welcome to being a brown actor in Hollywood and an immigrant. And, what I tried to do in this book is sort of give my take on the immigrant experience and my comedic take on sort of, life as a brown actor in a sort of Caucasian industry,
Now, you say the question, where are you from, is really complicated for you. You're born in Bombay, grew up in Bradford, England, moved to Florida mm-hmm. at the age of 16.
Right.
Why are you stopping and looking back and trying to figure out what home is, what your identity is, what place you're connected to?
You know, it's funny. I started writing this book just because I thought I had some interesting stories, and all of my writing, I have sort of examined the identity issue and the immigrant experience, ever from my one-man show to the movies I've written and stuff, and even on The Daily Show sometimes. But, as I explored this, these essays and writing this book, it sort of started to, open up for me, and I started to ask questions, and I ended up writing about things that I never intended to write about when I first set off on this journey of writing a book. So it was really a cathartic experience for me as well.
One of the things you did when you started thinking about home maybe being Bradford, England, was that you decided to go there and revisit where you came from. You were going to return triumphantly. It ended up not really being that. But
right.
did you find what you were looking for?
Well, I think, you know, what I ultimately discovered in that journey that I talk about in the book, which is which after 20 years of living in America, I decided to go back to the town that I had grown up in. And that sort of, is the structure that the book takes in some ways of this journey back home. And I, when I got there, I realized that, you know, I thought I was looking for a place, an identity. I end up sort of in the last stories, at the place where I first discovered my passion for acting, which is at this little children's theater in the north of England, and it had burnt down, and I stood there in this field, and I sort of had this image of this open field in front of me, and it sort of represented my life in many ways, you know, this idea of having to be an immigrant kid and invent oneself over and over again in new environments, and across three continents.
You got to be an immigrant kid in the UK and here in the US. How did the two experiences compare?
Well, you know, it's funny. I write about this in the book about the fact that, like, in the UK, I always found that, you know, as much as you if you're an Indian immigrant in England, like, it doesn't matter how long you've lived there, you're always in some ways going to be an Indian immigrant. And then the opposite was sort of true when I got to America, which is in America, you know, there was a sense of, like, it doesn't matter where you're from. You're an American now. And, you know, like, it doesn't matter that you come from a long history and culture. Just pledge allegiance to the flag. And I sort of have this joke about how Americans think about the rest of the world the way New Yorkers think about the rest of America, which is they don't, you know. So it was this sort of sense of suddenly being invisible. Because when I got to America and when my parents moved to Tampa, Florida in the 80s, and, you know, this was a town with one Indian restaurant. So I was the only Indian kid in my entire high school. And so people just thought I was Mexican, you know.
Well, you had early on, getting to the acting part of your life, you had sort of this conversion experience with Omar Sharif, mm-hmm. where you were aiming for Fonz and you ended up sort of veering in another direction. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, I grew up on American pop culture, right? So as a kid growing up in England, I was watching Happy Days. Fonz sort of represented to me what, you know, it was this American image of masculinity. It was sort of James Dean, you know, it was the leather jacket and riding around Milwaukee, Wisconsin on a motorcycle, you know? So that to me was what acting was. It was Hollywood. It was sort of this image that I, and then I saw Omar Sharif. And in this book, I talk about the story of how I discovered Omar Sharif. And he was the first brown actor in a Hollywood movie that I saw as a kid who was not playing a servant or a native or a Gunga Din type character. He was like a gentleman. And it sort of gave me the possibility of believing that I could perhaps do that, you know, it gave me the inspiration, I guess, in the way that, many years ago, Sidney Poitier had represented a sort of inspiration for young African-American actors, you know.
And did you actually meet him, or was that creative license?
Well, I did actually, I spent many years as a waiter in New York City when I first got there, and he was there at a party that I did stare at him across the room. I mean, I'm not going to give away the story, but there was a brief collision between the two of us, yes.
Now, when you did go into acting, you often found that there, as a brown-skinned actor in the United States, there was a set list of parts you were likely to be asked to play. What
right.
kind of roles were out there for you?
Well, I mean, you know, when I first started in this business, it was the typical sort of, there's a story in the book about how I, one of my first auditions in New York City was for a snake charmer in a commercial. And I remember when I went in, they said to me, do you know how to snake charm? And I was so desperate for the job that I actually remember saying to them, you know, I don't, but I'm Indian, so maybe it's in my DNA, you know, and hoping just to get this job. But there was a lot of roles like that where it was you were basically just stereotyping a cartoon version of your culture. And, you know, there's a word that all us Indian actors used to have at that time and still, you know, have which is called Patanking. And it basically is the sound of the Indian accent to the ear of Westerners, which is like patank, 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 you know. And so that was what those are the roles that we went in for, because that's the only thing that was available when I first started out in this business.
Well, let's fast forward a bit to your work on The Daily Show. How has this working on the show been different from some of what you're talking about so far?
Well, The Daily Show came along, you know, and suddenly I was able to, you know, speak. I mean, it's like no other job that exists. You know, I came to The Daily Show as an actor, and I had come from, like, you know, doing theater and stuff like that. And so when I got there, it was kind of it was a way to speak into the zeitgeist in some way, and talk about things in a way that I had never had the opportunity to before. And it was after 9/11. I started on The Daily Show in 2006. And so there was definitely a sense of, you know, speaking about the Middle East and being able to stand on that fence sort of between cultures and talk about America as an insider and an outsider at the same time. And that was a very powerful experience. And it was very interesting to me because as somebody who is raised Muslim, but not really very devout or practicing that much, you know, my parents thought it was absurd that I had been hired to be the senior Muslim correspondent on The Daily Show. In fact, I think my father's first thing he said to me was, is Jon Stewart crazy? Like, what's wrong with this guy, you know? Why would he hire someone who doesn't even know how to say Salaam Alaikum to be his senior Muslim correspondent? And I remember saying, but Dad, you know, it's a comedy show. And he said, well, I hope it's a comedy show. You know? And that was sort of the initial experience. And then over time, you know, I started, you know, they send you out. I ended up talking to a lot of people who were, you know, Islamophobes and kind of talking about the Middle East and all this stuff. And you start to realize that, like, there was a vacuum of that voice into the culture from the perspective of a quote-unquote Muslim, you know? So it was a very sort of bizarre experience, and has always been for me, you know?
And Jon Stewart, I understand that your audition surprised you by not asking for an accent.
Yes. Well, you know, that, again, it goes back to the idea of, like, you know, when you're a brown actor in Hollywood, like, most of the time you go in and they're like, could you do it once with the accent? You know, and then that's the one they end up using. So when Jon asked me not to do an accent, I was already sold. You know, I was like, I'm doing this job, whether we, it seemed... It was very refreshing and new for me to not be asked to do an accent, you know?
So you're an actor and a comedian, but most of America probably knows you for being funny on TV, on The Daily Show. But are there serious takeaways from this book or changes you'd like to see as an ambassador, I guess, for brown actors and maybe just brown people in America?
Well, you know, look, I mean, there is something about being I hate to call myself any kind of ambassador. You know, what I've been fortunate enough to do is be on a show that speaks into the zeitgeist as much as The Daily Show. And from a cultural perspective, I feel like, you know, as an actor and a comedian, from a cultural perspective, there is a sense of, like, wanting to represent the non-Caucasian actors in a way that we're not represented, really. You know, still a lot of times in Hollywood you will find that white is the normal, you know, and then everything else. I mean, when I was first going out for auditions, it would be like, you know, me, you know, a fat Greek guy and an Asian woman, you know, and it would just, and they'd be like, if it's not going to be a white guy, then let's just, it's open for anyone, you know, without ever, like, actually specifically identifying an ethnicity of any kind, you would end up sort of just representing some kind of non-Caucasian, sort of point of view that it was just not Caucasian for that moment, you know?
Well, Asif, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That was Asif Manvi, correspondent for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and the author of the new book, No Land's Man.